We're going to open the session. I'm Chris Yaren, and my friends Rolf and Dwight came to help me get started in this session on the blues by playing a song called Stormy Monday. They call it Stormy Monday. It's a classic blues song. Lots of people have covered, but it was originally written by T-Bone Walker. And I was going to sing it, but I'm really bad at it, and Dwight is much better, so even if he's not perfect, at least he's saving you from me. So we're going to play it together to get us started today.
Should we do the turnaround bomb?
Lord, have mercy. Lord,
Well, that gives us a chance to just experientially enter the blues and just free associate with me a little bit. When you hear a song like that, when you think about the blues, what sorts of things come to your mind?
Struggle.
Struggle. Others? Sadness?
Emotion.
Emotion?
Catharsis.
Catharsis.
South.
The South?
Mm-hmm.
Other thoughts?
Save honor.
What is it?
Life and love.
Life and love.
Pain.
Pain.
The human element. Pain.
Mm-hmm. The human element of pain. Mm-hmm.
Survival.
Survival.
Release.
Release. Great.
Black people.
Yep. A sort of black, black genre.
Inevitability of.
Of sorrow, yeah.
And struggle.
Yeah.
Poverty.
Poverty. So, just that sampling of reactions to the song and to our playing of it and to the associations you come with to the blues elicit a whole bunch of stuff about life. And it's really fascinating to me, and it sets a sort of tone for a conversation about the blues that not one person said a spiritual word, God, Jesus, the church, not even the spirit. So that is something that we want to just hold on to in our minds as we go through this reflection. And I want to say, I'm sort of brainstorming this whole session because I'm working on a book project called Broken Hallelujah, and I'm trying to think about the ways in which our human experience, like you were just describing, gets picked up and is sung in all kinds of, quote, secular music. And what that's doing, in a sense, is putting out there before God and everybody our circumstances in all their breadth. And I think it's related to certain kinds of genres in scripture, lament for one, but also wisdom literature, which doesn't reference God as much, but covers the whole gamut of human experience, from the Song of Songs and just this gorgeous sensuality to Ecclesiastes wondering about if there's any meaning in all this, to Job questioning radical suffering. So there's connections I'm trying to explore. And one of the places that exploration has taken me is thinking about blues. And the reason I've gone there partly is because I'm interested in the work of U2. And Bono has often said that he thinks God's like blues better than the spirituals because in blues you can tell the truth. So he always talks about lament psalms as being the favorite music of his childhood at church and listening to David shout at God. And that made me think, I should travel that road myself and learn more about the blues and not just have your garden variety association. So I've been digging deeper and reflecting on what I'm finding there with these kinds of questions in mind. So that's where I want to go together. So this is T-Bone Walker, and this is his version playing in the background. And he was from Dallas, Texas, and he's famous in the history of blues because he was one of the first innovators widely recognized as bringing the electric guitar. And it has a different sound than what we had, for sure. So the legend is that B.B. King says when he heard this song, it inspired him to pick up the guitar. So there's these kind of generations of blues inspired by particular songs. And this song has been covered by, and it happens a lot with early blues, that they've been covered by a lot of rock bands. So the Cream, Allman Brothers, Eva Cassidy, all covered that. Let me place that song a little bit in a framework I learned from This is the Allman Brothers version of Stormy Monday playing in the background. This is a sort of framework I got from John Michael Spencer's book, Blues and Evil. And he talks about how the background for the blues are field shouts. And there was a kind of geographic centeredness to the emergence of the blues in the Delta region in Mississippi and Arkansas, where the cotton plantations were. And so that background of sharecroppers and slaves before them working the fields and improvising these field shouts and songs, he says, is the background. And then he, as a second category, and the first real category of blues, describes country blues. And I didn't know this until I started digging further, but a lot of early blues were played on the banjo. And there was a lot of interconnection between Scots-Irish workers in that region of the South and African Americans, because they were both the most economically oppressed. And their influence of music went back and forth in this time in a way that it doesn't now. If you think about NASCAR country music and contemporary African American music, rap or whatever, there's not much influence back and forth in the way that there was at this time. So some of the characteristics he lists for this kind of music is the mixing of speaking and singing, and not the kind of smoothed out sound you might get later on, a kind of improvisational feel to it, and also a deeply religious sensibility. Lots of the early country blues, he points out, are saturated with religious imagery and even direct addresses to Jesus or to God. Then he says city blues was like when Muddy Waters went up to Chicago from the plantations in Mississippi, and the country blues gets electrified and it gets recorded and it gets smoothed out a little bit. So he says, with this generation of blues, you can still hear the world of the country blues, but you hear it in the context of and through the loudspeakers of the city. And see, we're still not even up to T-Bone Walker, where he places T-Bone Walker. He puts T-Bone Walker in the urban blues. And he says that partly what distinguishes this group is many of them didn't have the personal lived experience of the Delta culture, the plantation culture. They get it secondhand somehow. And so they're representing a tradition of blues. He calls it assimilative, less folkloric. And it's also more geared to the market of blues music. And so it's a little bit smoother in its style, more danceable. And you'll hear brass coming in, and so the orchestrations get bigger. W.C. Handy was doing that kind of stuff way back at the turn of the century, but by himself. And now there's this whole generation of blues figures. B.B. King is a really well-known name in that generation. And then the rock and roll blues, young whippersnappers in England hearing Muddy Waters when he toured, and others, Howlin' Wolf and others, when they toured, and just being totally blown away by this music and starting to play it. So like this is the Allman Brothers live at the Fillmore playing Stormy Monday with their own sort of southern rock feel. So the Devil's Music.
It was actually written by Muddy Waters, but I first heard it done by Muddy Waters, and it's called...
The Devil's Music is introduced by the Rolling Stones and Buddy Guy.
Buddy Guy is going to help us out.
This was from their most recent tour in 2005.
Thursday.
So right from the first line, you get an example of the kind of thing that at various points church folk said was of the devil. But part of the problem...
And the government.
And the government, too, enough. The long history of musicians getting arrested would take us another session. One of the problems with how blues has been characterized is that some of the really early serious scholarship was by English scholars, white English scholars, who tried to read the meaning in the blues, but they didn't understand the meaning of the blues. And so part of what happens is Paul Oliver wrote an important and sort of agenda-setting book in the 50s, and it was published in the early 60s. And the first title was The Meaning of the Blues. And here's a couple of things he said about the blues. The blues is devil's music, evil music, bereft of spiritual values. The blues was the song of a people who turned their backs on religion. And then a later book, also by a white English guy, Giles Oakley, The Devil's Music, A History of the Blues. So these kinds of broad sweeping interpretations of blues tradition are framing it in a particular way that becomes very influential. Not that it wasn't, in a sense, there. There's certainly themes about the devil in blues music, but part of the question I'm trying to raise with my own reading and reflection and in this session is this an accurate portrayal? What do you lose when you follow this popular interpretation of the blues as devil's music? It certainly plays on this divide between Saturday night and Sunday morning, between the profane and the sacred. And one of the places where that influences the interpretation of blues is just simply the long sweep of Christian history, and especially Protestantism, in this strong divide between the circle of saints and the lost, who are everyone else. And when that kind of dualistic world view is offered as a perspective on the world, then it's not very long until you start deciding who's in and who's out, who's evil or of the devil and who's saintly. And unfortunately, it's still, as I'll come back to at the end of the session, quite prevalent in our public life today, not just with analyzing the blues, but analyzing our international neighbors. So this scholarship characterizing the music as the devil's music has set the tone. And I want to open up some possible ways of thinking about the blues differently, and then look at some examples from blues history that complicate the picture. Here's Memphis Minnie. Waiting for her man to come back home, and she laid down at night and left the back door open the whole night. And the next day she gets a letter saying that he's dead. And she talks about the blues personified as a person coming to visit her in her sorrow. And so that's an example of a classic country blues song that has nothing to do with the devil. And there's lots of early blues that's like that. So how do you go about thinking about that? Well, here's some factors to consider. One is what I was talking about before, the cotton plantations in the Delta region and the whole world that implies for thinking about the emergence of blues. A couple of the aspects, if you think about first of all, the background of West Africa, and there's a lot of interesting research on the both musical and lyrical and spiritual connections between the blues and African-American music going back through the Atlantic Passage and into the countries of West Africa where they came from. So that's one element, which I'll talk about a little bit more, especially in terms of the religious aspects of it in a minute. And the whole movement of slavery and then freedom, but then the way that Reconstruction went and the incredible reversal of progress in imposition of Jim Crow laws and the disenfranchisement of African Americans and the whole sharecropper system out in these cotton plantations. So you have, on the one hand, freedom, but on the other hand, just tremendous suffering and marginality in that culture. And so that particular context, I think, is the first place that you really have to go if you want to come up with a different sort of interpretation than the standard one about blues as devil's music. And that really means doing what these British scholars are accused of not doing, which is not just asking about the meaning in the blues, but the meaning of the blues, where they emerged from. Other factors, the complex relationship to Christianity. There's a couple of ways that goes. One is the complex relationship in terms of traditional African religions and the ways in which they were brought and carried among African Americans in the South, and the Christianity that they experienced as a part of the culture of the slaveholding South, the white South. And a couple of pieces to say there. One is this Legba was a trickster god, a god that sort of represented the possibility of doing good and bad, of helping you or hurting you. And there's a lot of different versions of particular trickster kinds of figures in African religion, and I'm not a scholar in that by any means, but the way in which that comes in is really essential because it represents this understanding of a cosmos in which everything sort of is wrapped up together. You can't just separate the good from the bad. God is all good and the devil is all bad. There's this negotiation in life that you have to be responsible for, so the way in which they draw on Legba in terms of talking about the devil complexifies the devil in ways that our dualistic understanding of God versus Satan doesn't really allow. And then the whole sort of magic, Muddy Waters had a song about his mojo hand going down to Louisiana and getting this sort of blessing for musical skill. And the stories like that in blues culture are really common. And here's just a little tidbit from Spencer's book about this. As one Mississippi ex-slave said around the 30s, there's folks today what thinks every time they get sick that someone has put the jinx on them. And when a woman's husband leaves her, she thinks another woman has conjured him into leaving. The manipulatory character of hoodoo is just rife in this music, partly because it was present in the culture. The blues repertory up through at least the early 40s was replete with references to hoodoo as evidenced in such popular songs as Muddy Waters' Louisiana Blues and Muddy Waters' Mojo Hand. So understanding a little bit even about the way in which Christianity intersected with African religious traditions makes the picture more complex and makes us pause and say, well, we really have to understand more about how that worked. The other complexity is the complexity of slave Christianity over against the master's Christianity. And so the importance of the Exodus story and of Moses and of a creative reinterpretation of the prophetic voice of Christianity over against what they were being told by the white slave owners. So both of those play into reassessing. And then I pointed at this already. A factor to consider is the way in which we've all been shaped by a culture born of Protestantism that divides saint from sinner, body from soul, profane from sacred. And when you come out of this African blues perspective about a holistic reality in which body and soul are held together and joy and pain, then all of a sudden singing just about sex or just about your sadness that your man left you or your worry about what's going to happen to the crops isn't just secular. It's full of the stuff of life, and the stuff of life is what is religious. All of it together is religious. So thinking about a flip of frames in terms of that also helps us reassess. This is from another book I brought in, which is real groundbreaking in pushing back against this interpretation of blues as the devil's music. It's James Cone's book, The Spirituals and the Blues, in which he tries to show how they have a common ground and similarities rather than being polar opposite musics. And he says, the blues is a state of mind in relationship to the truth of the black experience, an expression of fortitude in the face of a broken existence. Someone said strength or fortitude or something like that when we were brainstorming words. So the blues isn't just a blue note. It's not just a musical fact, and it's not just a set of words that you would write in a song in a certain pattern about certain topics, but it's really a lived experience that comes out of suffering. That's what he's saying. And it's a willingness to speak the truth about it. So these are some things I'm working on as tools, as things I'd want to include in a reconsideration of the blues. So I'm going to do a couple of case studies of interesting figures that complexify the picture for those who sort of either dismissively or delightfully think of the blues as the devil's music. This is a guy who recorded under the name of Sun House, and he was on, let you listen to him a little bit. So you can tell both from his style and from the words that this isn't the classic slick devil's music that you might think when you hear the term blues. This is a really complex thing, and it's interesting. He had a lot of siblings, 17, and he wanted to be a Baptist preacher. He began preaching at age 15, but when he was young, he was taken down to Louisiana. His parents separated, and he started to hear a variety of early blues music and was really attracted to it, and so he started to learn guitar. And they moved back up to Mississippi Delta around Clarksdale, and he became really good at this style of music as they moved back up, and he built his skills in playing the blues. And there near Clarksdale, he met Robert Johnson and was a mentor to him. And Robert Johnson is often thought of as the father of the blues or the father of the Delta blues, and is very influential as the genre developed. And this song we're listening to is called John the Revelator, and he also wrote a famous song called Preaching the Blues, and that was his effort to try and reconcile and explore the tension between his sense of wanting to be a preacher, wanting to be in the church and in the gospel, but also feeling like the blues tell the truth and wanting to preach the blues. So this is an example of someone who's in the early years of blues trying to struggle with how to bring these traditions together. The White Stripes, if anyone knows the White Stripes, on their self-titled first album, did a cover of John the Revelator in one of their songs and dedicated the whole album to Sunhouse. So that's an example of the way in which this early music is still inspiring people. Here's another case study. This is Georgia Tom and a song that he did with Tampa Red called It's Tight Like That. So, it's all sexual innuendo, and pretty raunchy as you go through it. I mean, it's hilarious. And so this was one of his big hits. He was born in Georgia, and his father was an itinerant preacher and sharecropper, and his mom played music in the church. And so he was exposed to spirituals and learned piano, played with her piano and organ at church. And they moved to Atlanta, and he began working in a theater where he met some of the great early women jazz band leaders, blues singers. Then he moved to Chicago and went to a composition school and began writing both blues and he started to write spirituals because he was trying to make money. I mean, he wanted to write stuff for whoever would buy it, and both the church would buy it and the blues writers. Ma Rainey asked him to lead her traveling band in 24, so he went on tour with her. In 28, he wrote this, It's Tight Like That, which sold, I don't know, 7 million copies, some incredible figure for the time. Hugely popular song. So that's George Tom Dorsey, who also is known as Thomas A. Dorsey, the founder of the gospel genre. And this is a picture of him later in old age at Pilgrim Baptist in Chicago. So Thomas A. Dorsey, the same man, in 21 attended the National Baptist Convention and was inspired by this brilliant singing. And so he decided he was going to compose more sacred music, and he took a job as a director of music at a small Baptist church in Chicago and struggled with this. How do I fuse the blues as a musical genre with the spirituals? And he continued doing this back and forth in his work. And I'm going to back this up so you can hear the beginning of this, because he tells the story himself here about how he worked to bring the two together. While you're listening, I'll just put down the things so you can read them.
Blues, jazz, the gospel. I want to talk about the gospel songs that went into that field. I went out to go to St. Louis one morning to wake in a revival. I left my wife asleep in bed, got in the car, and went along. She was going to become a mother, and I was anticipating a great happiness, great joy on my return. But I got to St. Louis, and about the second night in the meeting, a telegram boy came and brought me a telegram. I opened it and read, "Your wife just died. Come home." I couldn't finish the meeting. Finally, I got home to Chicago the next morning, and it was so. I found it all true. It never moved the body. And that killed me off. I wanted to go back to blues. But after putting my wife away, the baby in the same casket, I went to the old poor old college in the music room there, Mr. Fry and I, just rosing over the keys. And seemingly the words, like drops of water from the crevice of a rock above, seemed to drop in line with me on the piano. Precious Lord, take my hand. Lead me on. Don't let me stand. I'm tired. I'm weak. I'm worn. Through the storm, through the night. Lead me on to the light. Take my hand, precious Lord, and lead me home. Now, God is blessed. I have another family. I have a wife, son, daughter, and a grandson about 78 years old. And the Lord has led me, and he will lead you. And I hope, some way, somehow, if you don't sing, precious Lord, take my hand, you will learn to sing and sing it with healing and fervor. God bless you and keep you.
So that's an example of, in a lifetime, this struggle for someone to put these genres together in a way that made sense to him. And in the end, Precious Lord becomes a gospel song deeply rooted in the blues. And it's an example of what James Cones is pointing to in his book, The Spirituals and the Blues, in terms of how he couldn't have written that song had he not had the blues in him. So that's a second case study. The third case study of this complexity is with Johnny Cash. Here we go.
I'm Johnny Cash.
This is the opening song from his concert at Folsom Prison.
I don't know where, I'm stuck in Folsom Prison, and time keeps dragging on. But that train keeps rolling all down the span and fall. When I was just a baby, my mama told me, son, always be a good boy, don't ever play with guns. But I shot a man in Reno just to watch him die.
So Johnny Cash was born down in that region, in Arkansas, the Delta region, and grew up poor. He worked on cotton fields from as early as age 5. And he grew up, also, as many of the people in that era and that place and time did, singing at church and hearing gospel music through church. And after he grew up, he joined the Air Force and then moved to Memphis, and he learned to play the guitar and wanted to be a singer. And he tried, if anyone's seen Walk the Line, the recent movie, so you have seen depictions of this, he's trying to get a recording contract at Sun Records. And he finally does, and one of his traditions from early on was to play prisons, and some of his biggest hits came out of those concerts. And the Folsom Prison Blues that I started with here was a number one hit when it came out. He had a lot of drug problems, especially through the late 50s and 60s, that caused lots of arrests and problems, dissolution of his marriage. And he never served prison time, but there's a kind of outlaw man in black image that he developed, and it partly was related to this real sensitivity to the life of prisoners and wanting to support, be an advocate for them, and also his own sort of image of himself as an outlaw. So this recording was at Folsom Prison near Sacramento, January 13th, 68. And it opened with that song, Cocaine Blues. There's a lot of what under one way of looking at the blues you would think of as devil's music. I shot a man in Reno just to watch him die. You know, at the line that we heard before I turned the volume down. So you could think of him in that way, but I would look for a way to interpret Johnny Cash out of the blues sensibility that holds contradictions together and doesn't try and look at the world in a dualistic way. This is him not long before he died. And listen to the last song that they played at Folsom Prison.
Here in Folsom Prison. And last night was the first time I've ever sung this song. Anyway, this song was written by our friend Glenn Shirley. And it song justice, Glenn. We're going to do our best.
So the song was written by an inmate in the prison, and a friend of Johnny's came to him that night before the concert in his hotel room and said, Johnny, I just want you to listen to this tape. There's an inmate here who's a Christian, and he's written this gospel song, and I just want you to hear it, and then if you'd mention it when you're there, just mention you'd heard the tape, it'd mean the world to him. And so he played the tape, and Johnny immediately said, we got to do it. And so he wrote down the words and got his band together, and they practiced it, and they closed the concert with it.
Inside the walls of prison, my body may be, but my Lord has set my soul free. There's a gray stone chapel here at Folsom, a house of worship in this den of sin. Would think that God had a place here at Folsom, but he saved the soul of many lost men.
Well, this concert happened to be at a really pivotal time in his life. It was the time when he really was able to overcome his drug addiction and married June Carter and answered an altar call at a church in Nashville and recommitted himself to Christian faith. And so it's not in a way surprising that he closed with a gospel song, but the bookends of that concert sort of represent the conflict he lived with his whole life between his mama's gospel. The last thing he recorded was an album called My Mother's Hymns or Mother's Hymns or something like that. And he just went through her hymn book and picked out her favorite hymns and recorded them. So this tension between the man in black, the outlaw figure, the bad guy, and the sweet gospel singer who's singing his mama's songs. So let me just close with some thoughts and see what thoughts you have. One of the claims that Spencer makes at the end of his book is that the urbanization and commercialization of the blues have emptied it of its deeper religious roots. So a lot of he would say a lot of the urban blues and what's come after it have been sort of just raunchy without that sort of rootedness in the religiosity that you see in the country blues. And he thinks that's partly because of what sells, because of the influence of executives at record companies who want to market the blues. But he says, and I think that there's lots of examples of this, the early blues still serves as a powerful teacher about how to speak the truth of life's suffering, of life's joy, of the complexity of our human existence. And I think that's why young singers are still drawn to it and go back and meet those players and sing those songs. Then I think we struggle with the continuing shadow of this dualistic version of Christianity, which wants those who have received Christ to sort of huddle up in a purity club and lob pamphlets over the wall at the lost and really be clear about who's in and who's out. And there's two, if you think about H. Richard Niebuhr's famous typology of different ways of relating Christ and culture, that works itself out really in two ways. Earlier in our culture, I think there was a sort of Puritan gung-ho feeling that Christ could transform culture in this world. We could actually become a city set on a hill, shining for the whole world to see. And I think over time, through partly the disestablishment of Christianity and secularization and also other kinds of disappointments and problems in our national life, especially in the last 30 years with a set of decisions like Roe versus Wade, a whole group of Christians shifted I would argue, from the Christ transforming culture to just Christ against culture. So you could think of, even though the religious right was trying still to have political influence, there was this sort of oppositional character to it. And you can see that if you think about the Focus on the Family media guides, for instance, which have a literal checklist you can go down to see, does it have swearing or sexuality or those sorts of things, to judge whether it's something for the saved or whether it's of the world and of the sinners. And what I'm working on is the idea that out of a theology of the cross, out of a Lutheran understanding of Christ and culture, there's a generative option for paradox, for holding together these things which so often are separated, holding together sexuality and spirituality, holding together body and soul, holding together our failures and our sorrows with our faithfulness and our joy. And so I want to continue to work on this and try and articulate some ways of responding not only to blues, but to popular music in general that embodies that effort to try and, out of our human experience, speak the truth plainly. In whatever way it comes out, it can be in punk, it can be in country. And there's a challenge, I think, for Christianity in our culture to have something other to say than good, bad, or my Christianity is private and it doesn't really relate to my mature engagement with the art sphere of arts and culture. So I don't have an answer to that yet, but that's my intuition, and that's why I've gotten into this in the first place, trying to think it through and follow that road and see if there's a more fruitful way we can engage this kind of, quote, secular music and material. So responses and thoughts from you all. Yeah.
I think it's interesting because certainly the growth out of the Delta and then seems to be that it needs to be included into the Industrial Revolution back still in the 1890s in the New York tenements and the blues that the European immigrants had in the sweatshops, but also in today's culture with the changing of our environment, and even Bob Dylan in one of his last albums talks about the working class and the struggle there that continues. And so be interesting to see. I mean, the blues just kind of keeps progressing.
Yeah.
Progressing along.
Yeah. And there's a way to say blues is the blues, but then there's a way that we can relate to it. We who didn't grow up in the Delta, who don't have the experiential sense. Like, one of the things Spencer raises in this book is can a white person write about the blues authentically? Well, he says, I think there are black people who would write badly about the blues and white people who would write well about it, but it matters how deeply you immerse yourself in the reality you're trying to speak about. So I think there are similar kinds of experiences out of which that kind of voice comes.
Certainly, there must be some blues in the single parent.
Yeah.
Trying to raise a child.
Yeah, let's go over here.
Well, I think also, like you alluded to, that there needs to be more of a place for lament in worship, maybe, or in the church in general. And there hasn't been necessarily an allowed place for strong lament of either in words and prayer. For some people, words are their expressive way, or, you know, poetry type ways of lament. It's throughout the Bible, as you alluded to and suggested, but we don't seem to really have as much place for it in our liturgies or in our everyday church life. And I think the biblical witness is great when it comes to how to show and express lament, but we have, you know, condensed the confession part of our service and made it very kind of quick and get it over with, rather than really talking through both confession and lament and sadness. And I think my most profound experiences in churches have been smaller communities who feel free to share in the prayers of the people really deeply and straightforwardly the experiences that they have, but we still don't have a place for a further kind of emotional expression of that. And I think I've been studying a little bit about Pentecostalism and the kind of the speaking in tongues kind of moments, I think in some ways are a catharsis release for people of expression that we've totally done. I mean, we don't have any catharsis release of emotion in the kind of frozen chosen churches. So,
yeah.
So I think there has to be a place for us to rediscover ways to have that full range of emotions of reality.
Well, I think that's really a great point and very true in my experience. And to take it one step further, I mean, one of the things that's really attractive about popular music is you actually get to sing about eros, you know, about passionate love and the beauty of bodies and the pleasure of touch. And all of that is so true, and we long for it. Who would want to live their life and not be touched? And how do we get to sing about it in church?
We've totally gotten rid of Song of Solomon.
Yeah, Jody.
Three real quick comments. One following on your comment. I think if I'm thinking about women performers, I think fairly often, Chris, I'm not sure about this, but if you went back, most of the males that you're talking about moved from the blues, and if they moved at all, they moved in the sort of spiritual direction and into the gospel.
Yeah.
And I think if you take a bunch of women, Aretha Franklin is one, Mahalia Jackson might be another. The movement is opposite. They start in the church. Their roots are in the church and in the church choir, and then they gain a broader audience. It might be really interesting to sort of weave that into your already rich argument here. The second thing, I'm taken back to 35 years ago when I was working in Mississippi on voting rights and voter registration stuff, and I was living with an extended black family in the Delta, sharecroppers, and every night, we'd go to the largest porch on their house, and there would be about six people with guitars, and mostly they were playing Robert Johnson, but they weaved in with absolutely no sense of a contrast. They weaved in spirituals, right? So you'd go right from a Robert Johnson blues into a spiritual, and people would know the words to all of them and sing along with all of them. So there was just it was a holistic kind of a thing. Nobody down there thought these were two different things.
Right. James Cone talks about blues as secular spirituals. Like they're in a sense the same genre spoken differently.
That's exactly
And that,
right.
that story makes a great example of that.
Just one last thought.
Yep.
I think the today 2008 version of your argument has to do with rap and hip-hop.
Yeah.
And whether or not rap and hip-hop is exclusively the music of the devil.
Yeah.
Or whether there's some really interesting and complicated, which is what I think, stuff in there that's worth looking at in the same way. And I think the same kinds of complexities you're dealing with here are very much alive in the discussion, mainly within the black community. The white community hasn't had much to say about that.
But. In the book, I'm for sure going there. And I've done work especially with Kanye West, who's also a Chicagoan. And it's all there in him. I mean, he's in a way an entry point for me to think about what's happening in hip-hop generally. Was there someone over here before we head off to Vespers?
It seems to me that the undercurrent of this dualism that we feel about sacred and secular concerning the blue is at the base of it is racism. And how the white church, even yet, there's a wonderful setting of the liturgy from the This Far By Faith hymnal that is it is so rich and the chorus is so wonderful, but it is heard by some white ears as being Saturday night. It's not Sunday morning. And so I find there's an undercurrent of racism going on.
Well, we have a village musician this week who's deeply steeped in African-American church music, and it's a specialty. And we did a musical Vespers on Wednesday night in which he did some gospel standards, Kirk Franklin and whatever, with the choir. And I had conversations later with some people, Episcopalians, not that Episcopalians are the only ones who'd react this way, but with people who just totally didn't find it worshipful. They found it more like pop radio, and they were unable to connect with it.
I had the privilege of leading it once, and I wish I could get to be in a black church and and do it, because it's really a beautiful setting.
Thanks. Thanks, everyone, for coming. We're at time, so let's head off for Vespers, but thanks for coming and thinking with me.